Today, we bring you the story of women in politics and government. And at the close of this program, as our guest speaker, we will present Mrs. Edna Gellhorn of the League of Women Voters, another of the Women in the Making of America.
...1939. More American women voters than ever before. More women equipped to play an important part in the government of their nation. Yet,
10 years ago, 9 women were serving in Congress. Now we have only 5.
10 years ago, there were 149 women in state legislatures. Now there are only 130.
Why this drop in the past decade? America's First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, knows the answer.
The decline of women in public office is due to the apathy of women voters. There are plenty of capable women ready to run for office if they thought other women as a whole would back them up.
In 1920, after 70 years of struggle, the women of America finally won the right to vote. But...
Yeah? And what have they done with it since they got it?
In 1920, after 70 years...
Well, pardon me, lady, for butting in like this, but...
Who are you?
Me? Oh, I'm just a mere man. Call me Mr. America. I've been listening to you for a number of weeks, and I feel you give too much importance to women. I think it's about time we men had a chance to say something.
Oh, all right, Mr. America. The airwaves are yours.
Well, how about it, now that you women have won the freedom of speech and education and citizenship and all? What are you going to do with them?
Well... Take Mrs. Roosevelt. I think she's a fine example of what can be done. Travels 42,000 miles a year, studying conditions in this country, and then reports back to her husband and America on what she finds.
And most of America feel that she ought to stay home and keep quiet.
Not most. According to a survey made by Dr. George Horace Gallup, 67% of the people approve of what she's doing.
Why doesn't she behave like other first ladies?
Because Eleanor Roosevelt has a different conception of her job. And she's determined to do that job as she sees fit. To remain a person instead of a personage, no matter what anyone says. She says that women who are willing to be leaders must stand out and be shot at.
Okay. I'll fire another bullet. What good has she done by tearing around like that and poking her nose into things?
Well, she saved the president's time and strength for more important things. And she's kept him and America posted.
But why should she? No other president's wife has taken such an active part in...
Now, that's where you're wrong, Mr. America. Abigail Adams was doing this very same thing 150 years ago.
Abigail Adams? Well, who's she?
Well, she was the wife of the second president and the mother of the sixth one.
I never heard of her.
Well, that's just why we are here, to tell the people of America about their important women. And if you don't mind, we'd like to get on with it.
Okay. On one condition.
What's that?
That I can heckle you with questions whenever I like. All right?
All right, Mr. America. I'll do my best to answer them. And now, if you'll give us your attention... In 1920, after 70 years of struggle, the women of America finally won the right to vote. But actually, that struggle had begun 3 centuries before, with Margaret Brent in Maryland. 1648, the Maryland Assembly is faced with grave danger.
The soldiers are threatening mutiny, and here our assembly sits, forced to delay its deliberations till the arrival of a woman.
Ah, it's ridiculous. Just because Mistress Brent happens to be executive for Governor Calvert and attorney for Lord Baltimore is...
We must be courteous to her, gentlemen. Although we aren't going to allow her to vote in the assembly.
But to delay at a time like this, a whole colony threatened with destruction. As if her counsel could help in stopping a mutiny.
I agree with you, gentlemen. It does sound a trifle ridiculous.
Oh, Mistress Brent, I...
And I apologize for keeping you waiting. I had a little business to attend to. A business of quelling a mutiny.
What's that, quelling a mutiny?
The soldiers merely wanted their salaries. I paid them.
I say, Mistress Brett.
How could you pay them? We haven't any money.
Well, I sold some of Lord Baltimore's cattle.
Now, why didn't we think of that?
Mistress Brett, you apparently have saved Maryland from disaster. Now, if there's anything that we can do to show our appreciation...
Well,
I'm sure that...
There's only one thing I really want, gentlemen.
Now, if you're going to bring up that subject of the vote...
Not vote, gentlemen. It has occurred to me that I really deserve 2 votes in this assembly.
2 votes? Egad.
One as executor for Governor Calvert, and the other as Lord Baltimore's attorney.
Listen to the woman.
Who is out of the question, Mr. Spence? You to have even 1 vote.
It's ridiculous and preposterous.
Though Margaret Brent was never allowed to vote...
And serves her right, say I. If that wasn't just like a woman, never satisfied. You know, I'm surprised you modern women haven't asked for 2 votes.
Perhaps if we did, Mr. America, the voting women could offset the ones that don't use their vote.
Well, now that's just the point. Why don't they use it?
We'll get to that later on. My point right now is that women were helping to govern America even before they had the vote. Women like Margaret Brent and Abigail Adams.
Yeah? Now, just what did she do?
Well, for one thing, she and her friend Mercy Warren are credited with having started the committees of correspondence that spread propaganda from town to town, stirring the American colonies to revolution.
You don't say. And she started it?
Well, according to some authorities. Abigail and Mercy used to write letters to leading men and women discussing the situation and then read their replies aloud to the assembled townspeople. And later, when Abigail's husband went to England as America's first foreign ambassador, she kept him posted.
Still, I report to you, John, on the state of the nation. I have no security that every letter will not be broken open and copied and transmitted to Congress and to English newspapers.
Have courage, dear heart, my partner in all my joys and sorrows. I must entreat you to share with me in the struggle.
How dearly have I paid for a titled husband. Should I wish you less wise, that I might enjoy more happiness? Nay, I consider myself and my family as the small dust in the balance when compared with the great community.
Now, there's a sensible woman, willing to remain at home and work behind her husband as an influence in government.
Yet even Abigail Adams argued against it.
Influence is not government. Unless you give the women some voice in the laws of America, I fear they will rebel.
And the women did rebel, signing their own Declaration of Independence, demanding an equal voice in the government. Among them, Anna Dickinson, first woman to become a leader in a political party. During the dark years of the Civil War, when newspapers North and South were attacking Lincoln as a bloodthirsty demagogue, Anna Dickinson joined the Republicans and stumped the country in his defense, while people flocked to her lecture halls.
Every seat filled, and still they come. If Anna Dickinson doesn't win a second term for Abe Lincoln, I sure miss my guess.
I can hardly wait to hear her speak. She must be marvelous.
She's the American Joan of Arc. That's what she is. The savior of our country.
And only 22 years of age.
You should have heard her talk to our Union troops, Mary. They almost worship her.
Oh, I can hardly wait.
Sorry, sir. Every seat taken.
But I've come 20 miles to hear Miss Dickinson.
It's Matthew Brady, leader of the Democrats over in Rock County.
I hate to see him turned away. If we could get them to vote for Lincoln.
I'll give him my place, John. But
Mary, you've been counting on this.
Oh, that's all right. You can sit here, Mr. Brady.
Oh, thank you.
I'm not staying.
Well, that's mighty nice of you, ma'am, but I don't want to put you out.
Well, it's more important for you to hear her than for me. You see, I can't vote for Mr. Lincoln anyhow.
Women playing their part in politics, some of them stellar roles upon the stage of history, others the steady, unspectacular woman's role behind the scenes.
Women urging, campaigning, organizing, raising money.
More and more women stumping the country for their political candidates.
And yet, because they couldn't vote, women had no voice in choosing the planks for the party platform. Still, they kept on campaigning, while state after state in the West granted woman suffrage. By 1912, 9 states in the Union permitted their women to vote.
That year, women were included among the delegates to all political conventions.
By 1916, there were 4 million women voters.
That year, women helped to nominate the presidential candidates, all of whom declared themselves in favor of woman suffrage.
By 1920, women were voting all over the land.
That year, women began at last to have some voice in the policies of their political parties.
Gradually, state after state passed a law that women should have equal representation with men in all political committees. Today, in 1939, the governor of New York signs that law, the 19th state.
That law is going to put an awful crimp in our style. That is, if anybody pays any attention to it.
What do you mean, Mr. America, if anybody pays any attention?
Well, it's one thing to put a law on the statute books, and it's something else again to change an old American custom. I'm afraid you'll find that politics of this country will be decided in the little back rooms full of cigar smoke. Of course, if you ladies want to come in and have a cigar...
I suppose you'd rather have us out campaigning for you and raising money.
Well, now, speaking for myself, I'm all for you having a voice in politics. I think you've earned it.
In the name of Mrs. America, I say thank you. And now that we've proved our worth...
Oh, hold on there. You've proven your worth in politics, but we're supposed to be discussing women in politics and government. How about that? What have you got to show for yourselves?
Well, we have 162,000 women working for the government.
162,000? Well, what are they doing?
Here's what they're doing.
14,000 are serving as postmistresses.
Thousands more are pounding the typewriters, filing the bills, sorting the papers of the nation.
Women watching the rise and fall of rivers for flood control.
Women inspecting the factories, improving the tenements, collecting the customs.
Choosing America's books, nursing America's disabled veterans, teaching America's children how to play.
Women working in every department of the government that deals with health or home or children.
Go throughout the country, Mr. America.
Go into the county seats and you'll find a woman agent whose job it is to help other women make better homes and raise happier families.
Go into America's orphan asylums, her public hospitals. You'll find women at work.
Go into her courts and prisons. You'll find police women, constables, sheriffs, judges.
What? No game warden.
Well, the fact is, we do have one, Mr. America, on a little trout stream in Connecticut. And when mere men go there to fish...
Hey, Jim, look, I got him in my net.
Boy, and what a beauty. That's worth a whole day's fishing.
Well, thank the Lord we won't have to go home empty-handed.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, but you'll have to throw that fish back in.
Oh, I beg your pardon, ma'am. We didn't know this was private property.
It's not. I just happen to be the warden here.
The warden?
But we have licenses.
I'm afraid that won't do you much good. Only women are allowed to fish here.
Women? Say, what is this anyhow?
This is the Woman's Trout Reservation, where they can learn to cast flies and keep still at the same time. If you gentlemen want that fish, you'll have to tell your wives to come here and catch it.
I might have known it. Well, I guess we men haven't any precinct left that you women haven't invaded.
Well, Mr. America, you asked what 162,000 women were doing in government.
And a pretty poor showing, I'd say. How about the big jobs?
Well, perhaps you've heard of Frances Perkins, first woman to sit in the president's cabinet?
Yeah, and what she done? Tied labor up in knots. She should have known that was no job for a woman.
Why isn't it?
Why, because labor's a man's job. She just doesn't belong there.
There are some men who would disagree with you. Heywood Broun, for instance, in his newspaper column.
Frances Perkins is a woman of great ability and is better informed about her own field of activity than any secretary of labor in recent years. And yet her effectiveness has been seriously impaired by a bad press.
You see, Mr. America, it's just as Mrs. Roosevelt says. A woman leader must expect to be shot at. Perhaps that's why Frances Perkins tried to turn down the job.
Turn it down?
So you had forgotten that back in 1933, newspapers were shouting other headlines.
Miss Frances Perkins notifies President-elect Roosevelt that she does not want to be considered for any cabinet post.
It's because of the great opposition, Mr. Roosevelt. All the time I've been an industrial commissioner of New York, there has been sniping at me by opponents.
And the president said...
Well, you're not afraid of them, are you, Miss Perkins?
Well, not for myself, no. But if this should handicap your administration, you'll be criticized for appointing a woman.
I'm appointing the person I think best qualified for the job. No, Miss Perkins, my mind's made up. Let a critic say what they may.
Well, I guess Frances Perkins has been struck by enough bullets without me firing any more. But if you can show me one thing she's accomplished,
apparently, Mr. America, you don't read the newspapers. On the front page of the Times just last Sunday, there was an article saying that the Employment Service, under her Department of Labor, had placed 9.5 million people in jobs with private employers, 8.5 million in non-relief government jobs, and...
Okay, okay, you win. I ought to know better than to argue with a woman. But now, what about the other big positions in government? What else have you got to show?
Nellie Taylor Ross, former governor of Wyoming, now director of the United States Mint.
Florence Allen, judge of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Josephine Roach, slated to head the new National Department of Health.
Ruth Bryan Owen, United States Minister to Denmark. She was a pioneer in diplomacy, blazing a new trail for American women. While another pioneer, Amelia Earhart, applauded.
It takes a very courageous woman to strike out in a new field, as Mrs. Owen is doing, when the world still does not regard women as persons. And it also takes a very courageous man to admit that a woman has the qualities needed for success in an official diplomatic post.
Out toward a new horizon sailed Ruth Bryan Owen, destined to meet and marry a captain of the Danish Royal Guards, to be received by a king and queen and prove herself a true diplomat. To the sound of drums, the tall, stately figure of the new American minister moved down the royal audience chamber, while lords and ladies watched and King Christian nodded approval.
Her Excellency, Ruth Bryan Owen, Minister from the United States of America.
Madam Minister.
Your Majesty.
In the name of the people of Denmark, I bid you welcome.
Your Majesty is most gracious. I bear this letter from the President of the United States, containing my credentials as Minister to Denmark, and, as Your Majesty has suggested, envoy to Greenland.
Well, the last is only a matter of form, because Greenland is a possession of Denmark. We would never expect you to go there.
Oh, I regret to hear you say that, Your Majesty. I've been looking forward to my visit to Greenland.
But no minister to Denmark has ever undertaken that journey. Greenland is so cold, so barren.
Is there any reason, other than my own comfort, why I should not go?
No, madam. Most ministers seem to feel that reason enough.
Then, with Your Majesty's permission, I am still looking forward to my visit to Greenland.
With my permission and my commendation, Madam Minister.
Ruth Bryan Owen has proved that she can do a difficult job and do it well. But probably no woman in government has ever had so hard a trial as that of our first Congresswoman, Jeanette Rankin. The first woman elected to public office, the first victory of women voters. On April 6th, Jeanette Rankin was called upon to make the most important decision of her life involving her America. President Wilson had asked Congress to decide whether America would enter the World War. The House was tense. Every eye turned upon the white-faced woman as the clerk drew near her vote.
Mr. Barber,
I vote yes.
Look at Miss Rankin. She's in deep distress.
I wonder how she'll vote.
Mr. Shanley.
I vote yes.
I can't vote for it. I can't. They're watching you, Jeanette. The men are just waiting to see what you'll do. But war is murder. They'll call you a traitor if you vote against it. I don't care what they call me. The reputation of every woman in America depends on you. Their whole future in government.
Mr. Green.
I vote yes.
You're next, Jeanette. I can't. I can't. Don't make a scene, you fool. They're just waiting for that.
Miss Rankin. Miss Rankin.
Why doesn't she speak?
Why, she's crying.
Miss Jeanette Rankin.
I want to stand by my country, but I cannot vote for war. I vote no.
Time has validated Jeanette Rankin's decision.
Her decision, perhaps, but not her emotion. Now, that's just the trouble with women in government and politics. They're too emotional. If they want to mix in this sort of stuff, they ought to learn to take it. And I'd like to see one woman that can.
You would? Well, as it happens, there's one right here with us. Mrs. Genevieve Earle, the only woman member of the New York City Council. I'll tell her that Mr. America would like to meet her.
Oh, well, now, really, I didn't mean... That is, I wouldn't want to bother her.
Oh, it won't be any bother at all. She loves to talk. Mrs. Earle, would you mind answering a few questions?
Not a bit. I've been waiting to get my innings.
Well, then, Mr. and Mrs. America, I give you Genevieve Earle, one woman who's fully equipped to sit on the governing council of America's largest city. After studying government in school, she started in as a volunteer worker. She's been serving New York City for 30 years, and this is her first paid job. One of our most outstanding citizens.
Oh, nonsense. You'll find lots of women doing the same kind of work.
But you will have to admit that you've spent your life in devotion to the government.
Well, I'd hoped I still had some of it left to spend. I see that Mr. America here is mentally counting on his fingers.
Oh, no, I wasn't.
Well, the answer is that I'm as old as the Brooklyn Bridge.
Oh, really, Mrs. Earle?
I want to congratulate you for coming here today and butting in. That took real courage. And I agree with a lot of the things you've said.
You do?
Absolutely. Especially that about their emotions. If women expect to get places in government, they can't expect to have special privileges. As Mayor LaGuardia said to me when he swore me in, remember, Jen, you've got to take it on the chin with the rest of the boys. A woman in office is still on trial. And when one woman fails, all women fail.
Well, how did you ever happen to get into this sort of thing? Did you feel yourself called?
Not called, convinced. Government's the biggest industry in this country. Why, we spend $449 million a year here in New York City alone. Why not spend it well and get something out of it?
I agree with you there, Mrs. Earle, but what can a mere citizen do about that?
Why, the citizens, the voters, are the most important figures in the government. They determine its policies according to the people they choose. Every time you vote, you decide the fate of a whole generation of Americans for years to come.
I suppose you were elected largely by the women's vote.
Oh, there's no such thing as a women's vote in New York City. And I don't think there should be. Women and men, too, ought to vote for the best qualified candidate, irrespective of sex.
Well, now, that's the sanest idea.
Well, it's not my idea. That's what the League of Women Voters has been preaching for the past 20 years.
And I'll bet that 50% of the women in America just vote the way their husbands tell them to. That is, if they vote at all.
75% might be a closer estimate.
Then what's the good of women having the vote, Mrs. Earle? What have they done with it?
Well, for one thing, they've put through a lot of social legislation. Child labor laws and minimum wage requirements and workmen's compensation. Then, of course, they've repealed the 18th Amendment.
Yeah, after the way they campaigned for prohibition. If that's not just like a woman, always changing her mind.
Well, at least they were willing to admit their mistake when they found they'd made one, instead of leaving it upon the statute books. And you'll notice that though it had taken them about 80 years to win prohibition without the vote, it took them only 5 years to win repeal with it.
Well, Mrs. Earle, you certainly seem to know the answers. No wonder you're a city councilman, a woman. Say, what do they call you?
Councilman.
I should think it might be rather embarrassing at times.
It is, especially at times like the St. Patrick's Day parade.
Why, what happened?
Well, when I heard that it was customary for all councilmen to march in the parade, I, of course, agreed to march with them. But when I received my official directions, I discovered that the approved costume for members of the city council will be cutaway coat, striped trousers, high silk hat. Spats were optional.
Well, that encourages me. I guess it's still a man's world after all.
I guess it will be, Mr. America. Till more women wake up to the opportunities awaiting them in government, if they'll train for it.
It is now my privilege to introduce one of the outstanding citizens of the Middle West, Mrs. Edna Gellhorn. Her services to her community have been recognized by the mayor of St. Louis, who appointed her to the Board of Children's Guardians, and the governor of Missouri, who invited her to serve on the Social Security Committee of St. Louis. Because of these distinctions, and as an active member in the League of Women Voters, we are proud to present Mrs. Gellhorn, speaking from Chicago.
Maybe New York's Mr. America is already convinced and will never again ask, what have women done with the vote? But we realize that other Mr. Americas will continue to ask this question reproachfully. Of course, the ballot did not transform us into political angels. After all, women are people too. And as even Mr. America admitted, women have not been welcomed into the inner circles of the political parties. We are left standing outside the back rooms full of cigar smoke, where even a cigarette won't get us in. It is also true that a traditional sense of political inferiority has kept many women silent. But if they were ever politically inferior, they need be so no longer. With the radio bringing the news of the world to her dishpan and washing machine, Mrs. America can know as much about world affairs as her husband, perhaps more. One answer to the question, what have women done with the vote, has already been given in this program. You have heard the achievements of a few women in office. You have also heard about the social welfare legislation many women have worked for. But it was not long before women realized that good laws on the statute books were not enough. We must also have good people to administer them. We must find the men for the jobs, not the jobs for the men. The merit system, not the party bosses, must choose the men and women who do our government housekeeping. That is why a nationwide campaign for the merit system is occupying the time and interest of the organized women voters in the country today. Statesmen have said that if the National League of Women Voters, the organization Mrs. Earle called the best school she knew, does nothing more for 10 years, it has justified its existence by an organized effort for trained personnel in our government. The League of Women Voters realizes that this is a continuing responsibility, not a job to be finished in 1 year or even 10. That is why it's a woman's job. Every housewife, and we're all housewives, knows that a good job of housekeeping takes 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So does a good job of government. As housewives, we know, too, that when we do our job best, nobody notices that it's being done. That is the way we work in government. When we stop watching how our laws are administered, the community suddenly wonders how things got so bad. Woman's job has always been to keep people well and happy. Her work for public welfare in government is the most recent expression of her age-old calling. Democracy, like housekeeping, has its daily routine. Women who, through centuries, have learned the value of daily chores well done have already brought their skill and interest to the daily routine of our democratic government. Many of them have been faithful in small things. Some have been rulers over many. We have enlisted our strength in the battle for justice, equality, and liberty. Can democracy have too many defenders? Let Mr. and Mrs. America work together in behalf of the democracy we prize.
Women in Politics and Government is the seventh in the series Women in the Making of America, a program devoted to pioneer women in the history of our country. Women in the Making of America, based on an idea of Eva Hansel, is written by Jane Ashman. The incidental musical score is composed and arranged by Leet Stevens, and the orchestra conducted by Joseph Hunty. Next week, Women as Homemakers. Mrs. Helen Judy Bond, president of the American Home Economics Association, will be our guest. Women in the Making of America is a presentation of the Federal Theater Radio Division, a project of the Works Progress Administration in association with the Women's Activities Department of the National Broadcasting Company.